Welcome to Clearly Quaker, an ongoing series of podcasts by Salem Quarterly Meeting, part of the Religious Society of Friends. Salem Quarterly Meeting is an association of seven Southern New Jersey Quaker meetings within Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. The program at Salem Quarterly Meeting's September gathering was about moving toward equal justice, freedom, and reform. The first speaker was Lisa Garrison, who has led tours of the Underground Railway sites in Cumberland County. She brought a sense of history as she recounted how Quakers know prisons from the inside out. She is a member of Greenwich Friends Meeting. Lisa was followed by Elena Flynn, Esquire, of the Superior Court of New Jersey, coordinator of the Advisory Committee on Minority Concerns, Vicinage 15. She talked about bail reform in New Jersey.
Hello, everyone. I just wanted to say a little bit about the genesis of this program. I think that the first seeds for it were probably planted 4 years ago when Salem Quarterly Meeting, I worked with Salem Quarterly Meeting to organize a bus trip of the Underground Railroad in Western Cumberland County. And in researching the origins of the first Quakers to come here, I couldn't help but begin to notice how many Quakers had been incarcerated. This idea grew into doing this program when Mary Woodruff invited me to be part of an Equal Justice Committee that she was putting together in Cumberland County. And finally, I've always been interested in the Fund for Sufferings, which is a Quaker committee that I encountered through my work with Quaker grantmakers and the Willits Book Trust of Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. And by having a conversation with Clerk Lee Garner, I was able to find Justin Logry. Justin Logry, who is actually a lawyer on our side of the Delaware River. And I met Elena through the Equal Justice Committee, and the three of us decided to do this program. One of the startling things that I encountered when I first looked at Quakers and imprisonment was actually, I wasn't even thinking about imprisonment. I was looking at early queries or the questions that Quakers use today as soul-searching frameworks for guiding ourselves in our quest to live the kinds of lives we wish to live. And when I looked at what the first two queries were, one of them was, which friends imprisoned on account of their testimony died in prison since this yearly meeting? That is from 1682, which would have been right after it became legal for Quakers to actually gather together. In the first 40 years, it was illegal for more than five Quakers to ever gather. And the second query was, which friends in the ministry in their respective counties departed this life since the last yearly meeting? It's striking for those of us today because our queries are really oriented towards our internal search, the way we steward our meetings, our peace testimonies, but these queries were used as more than Quaker cones. They were actually used as data collection devices. Quakers were still trying to map out who they were and really the kind of vulnerability that the sect was experiencing. At the time, one in three Quakers in London was in jail. The conditions in prison were really horrendous during this period of time. George Fox was actually in situations where urine and excrement came up to his shoes. There were rooms with 30 or 40 people, and Quakers were constantly being thrown in jail for things that it's hard to imagine could have been considered illegal, but it included not tipping your hat or taking your hat off to a person of higher social status, which in England was considered to be very important. And for Quakers at the time, it wasn't even really a social justice issue so much as it was that Quakers believed everyone, if there's any judgment, it's an inward judgment. And all people in their inward lives are equal. So Quakers were thrown in jail for blasphemy, for not paying tithes to the Church of England, and for the smallest kinds of offenses, including being really obnoxious and interrupting Anglican ministers. So I think that even when it became legal for Quakers to meet and they weren't threatened by jail, there were still it was still a very uncomfortable situation for Quakers in England. And this is one reason why George Fox, who spent 6 years in prison, and that's less than many people did, but George Fox came to our part of the world and spent time with the Indians investigating whether this would be a good place for Quakers to settle. And one of the things that he felt was that there were alliances, both in terms of peace testimony, in terms of a commitment to trade and cooperation with the native Lenape people here. And he felt that this could be a really safe place. And it's kind of important to point that out because it was not safe in other parts of the New World at that point. In Boston, four Quakers were actually murdered, killed for their beliefs. In England, nobody was sentenced to death, but thousands of Quakers did die because of the horrible conditions in prison. And this was the impetus for Quakers when they actually got out of prison, and even Quakers who were trying to abide with friends that were incarcerated, was to start working for better conditions. And one of the things that Elizabeth Fry in England tried to work on was the whole notion of trying to give people meaningful work. Quakers didn't actually come up with solitary confinement. That was actually a Calvinist's idea. And that particular person named Howard had no intention for it to be used in the kind of punitive way that it eventually became used for. His idea was that silence could be a form of repentance, more in the keeping with what you would think Quakers would be coming up with. But Elizabeth Fry wanted people to have work, and when she went into the prison, she encountered women who had children, and there wasn't proper bedding. So she began to organize other women to bring sewing materials into the church so that women could make beds for their children. And she organized schooling, not the church, the prison, organized schooling in the prison for the children that were in there with their mothers. So these gradual reforms, which included separate rooms, that was what Quakers were pushing for, separate rooms for prisoners, who at that time were 30 in a room, began to come about very, very slowly. But when Quakers did come to Salem County with John Fenwick, and Quakers came to Burlington within a couple of years, one of the first things that they did was create a document, a legal document, the concessions and agreements of the proprietors, freeholders, and inhabitants of the province of West Jersey. And West Jersey at that time was led by Quakers, and the document that they created actually kind of was 100 years earlier than the Bill of Rights. It included a lot of the kinds of concepts that you found in the Bill of Rights. And one of them was that there was no provision for arson, no provision for witchcraft, all of which were considered to be crimes in other part of America at the time. No penalty for murder was recorded. And a century before the Bill of Rights, it stated, no proprietor, freeholder, or inhabitant shall be deprived or condemned of life, liberty, estate, property, or any way hurt in his or her experience without a fair trial. So this was actually a very progressive document in its day. And it was one of the reasons why it also included a very important testimony stating that no one would be persecuted or banished for their religious beliefs. Now, this was really important because that was not true in Puritan parts of America at the time. I mean, the Puritans were arriving on vessels contemplating the end of days and thinking about killing Quakers and Catholics. So having a place like this that was safe for Presbyterians, Baptists, Quakers, Native people, and having the rights of Native people written in this document was very unusual in its day and set a kind of tone of tolerance and affirmation in our region that we like to think is still alive and well today and something that we can nurture and protect. In addition to what was happening in South Jersey, William Penn was able to outlaw the death penalty until 1718, when English criminal law eventually overrode that. But I think that's very important, and many Quakers uphold and work towards that today. I just remember vividly an experience in my youth when I was invited to be part of a Salem Quarterly Meeting overnight experience for young people in Salem that Mike Wyda organized. And Bill Waddington was speaking to us. You may have to correct me with this story, but the story as I remember it was a story he told about being in the Merchant Marine and going through the Gulf of Mexico and having his bunkmate wake up late at night and say to him, "Bill, I murdered a man." And Bill just let him speak. He didn't feel it was his job to report this person to the authorities. It would have, in fact, been against Quaker testimony to do so. And it was kind of the first time that I understood what it means to bear witness to another person's soul. And I think the young people in the room came to understand it through his story. We have today many organizations that are working for prison reform. And they include Alternatives to Violence, which was started by Quakers and then quickly embraced other faiths. And most recently, O.J. Simpson is crediting Alternatives to Violence with transforming his mindset. The American Friends Service Committee has been working on prison reform, and importantly, the Friends Committee on National Legislation has a criminal justice arm, and with the Council on Churches, they co-lead a national criminal justice initiative that is working for reforms. And one of the most important reforms is bail reform, which is something that's happening nationally now. And when I spoke with Jose Wass, who is in charge of this initiative for the Quakers, actually he's a Unitarian. Quakers like to hire outside our faith. But he stated that New Jersey is very far advanced in this area, further ahead than most places in the country. And to explain a little bit more about that, I'd like to introduce Elena Flynn, who's the Affirmative Action Equal Opportunities head of the Superior Court of New Jersey, Vicinage 15. And for those of us that are a little bit vague on that, Vicinage 15 encompasses Cumberland, Salem, and Gloucester County. Before I introduce you, I also just want to say we're very privileged not only to have some members of the Equal Justice Committee here today, but we have our Vicinage 15 prosecutor, Jennifer Webb McCray, here. Jennifer? Oh, just Cumberland County, I'm sorry. And our Cumberland County public defender here, a public defender, Joellen Jones.
Is that why you don't sit?
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the Mickleton meeting and the quarterly meeting and the Fund for Sufferings and the Equal Justice Committee of Cumberland County for providing this opportunity for me to speak with you about New Jersey's criminal justice reform program, and specifically bail reform. As Lisa was saying, it is something that New Jersey is in the vanguard of in this national movement. So in 2014, you may recall, New Jersey voters voted for a constitutional amendment to the state constitution, which changed the nature of bail in the state. So it moved us from a traditional bail program or a traditional bail that was based on monetary ability to pay to a bail system that is based on an assessment of risk. So, and that is the national trend. It seems like every time you pick up a newspaper, you read about something on the national scene or another state looking into how to move from a monetary bail system, which allows people who have resources to bail their way out of jail pending their trial, to something that's based on risk. So we are in the vanguard. We haven't been working on it as long as the Quakers have, so you may be thinking that we're late to the party, but in fact, we are one of the first states to implement this type of reform. So the focus of our criminal justice reform, and this, I should say that the constitutional amendment, the legislature reacted by providing supporting legislation with overwhelming bipartisan support, and that legislation was signed by the governor. So there is, across party, a lot of support in this state for bail reform and criminal justice reform. There are other provisions with criminal justice reform that don't involve strictly bail issues. I'm just going to focus on bail today. So the focus, again, is to try and keep people out of custody before they're tried, because the bedrock principle of our criminal justice system is people are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. And that is, intuitively, there is a fundamental fairness issue there, that people who have money shouldn't be treated better than people who don't. And I think that that is an issue that grabs people's attention without much effort. But there's a lot of other less obvious things that happen to people who couldn't afford to bail their way out of jail. And those include, well, just by way of background information, a 2013 study found that 12% of county jail populations, which is 15,000 people on any given day, were being held in custody prior to conviction because they were unable to pay a bail of $2,500 or less. Some people can't afford to pay a bail of $50 and remain in custody because they can't raise $50. And people who can't make bail under the old system remained in custody on average for 314 days prior to conviction while they were presumed innocent. So that's an average. So many people remained in custody for much longer and some people for much less time. So what happened to people who remain in jail for 314 days prior to conviction? Well, you lose contact with your family. You can lose child custody. You probably lose your job. You lose your housing. And in some cases, you can lose access to medications that you need. Other things that are happening to people, or would happen to people who were in custody prior to trial, our studies show that people plead guilty more often. If you are in custody before conviction for a period of time that is the same or exceeds the period of time you would serve if convicted, you are likely to think about pleading to a crime you may not have committed. And that can have lasting, horrible results for you for the rest of your life. Also, people who are in custody prior to trial are more likely to be convicted. And when they are convicted, they are more likely to be sentenced to prison and receive harsher sentences. So the need for bail reform is critical. And there is overwhelming support for it, both in the state and now nationally. So how does it work? What can we do? How do we move from a monetary-based system to a system based on assessment of risk? And what risk are we measuring? Well, traditionally, bail was used to guarantee or ensure that you show up for trial. So you would either pay a monetary amount or a bond, so a fraction of a monetary amount, or use the services of a bondsman to ensure that you'll show up for trial. Traditionally, there was not an analysis of whether or not you were at risk to society if released. Under a new system, they evaluate risk of your risk of flight or the risk that you won't show up for trial. They evaluate the risk that you will reoffend if released pending trial. And there's an evaluation of the risk that you will commit a violent offense pending trial. And they do this through an assessment tool called the Public Safety Assessment, which is an objective risk assessment tool that was developed by the Arnold Foundation. It has been through testing and in other jurisdictions, including the federal government, I think in Kentucky and Arizona, and there's been a lot of groundwork and research put into utilizing this tool in the state of New Jersey. So it is objective. It works on an algorithm that weighs various different factors, which include, and I have to read them because there are a lot of them, include a defendant's age, the current violent offense, the pending charges, whether there are disorderly persons convictions, prior indictable convictions, prior violent convictions, prior failure to appear in the last 2 years, prior failure to appear older than 2 years, and prior sentence to incarceration. So the algorithm weighs these factors and generates a risk score. And that risk score can be used by law enforcement and judicial officials when making pretrial detention decisions. So the public safety assessment tool is used as a guide about pretrial detention, but it is not a decision maker. It creates a rebuttable presumptions about what decisions should be made, and it's a form of guidance. The final authority is always remains vested in judicial officials and at some levels law enforcement officials when they're bringing the complaints to the judicial official. So it creates a rebuttable presumption, but deviation from that presumption must be documented in writing. And this brings to our system a heightened level of transparency and accountability, because we now see and are in a position to research decisions that are being made, both in compliance with the public safety assessment and in deviation from the public safety assessment. And from a minority concerns point of view, this is going to be a very powerful tool, because this data can be married or combined with demographic data to try and identify disparate impact issues and eliminate issues of unconscious bias. So how is this public safety assessment used? I'm going to talk about the two critical points at which it's used. One is when law enforcement officials are deciding what kind of complaint to bring. So there are two kinds of criminal complaints that can be issued. There is a summons complaint, which can be issued and doesn't involve pretrial detention. It's kind of like getting a traffic ticket. You're notified of the charges and you're told to show up. And nobody's talking about putting you in jail pending your trial. So clearly that's the best kind of complaint to get. The other kind of complaint is a warrant complaint. And if law enforcement determined that a warrant complaint is appropriate, that means they're thinking about pretrial detention. So in the past, under our old system, a law enforcement official, a warrant complaint in all cases has to be approved by a judicial official, generally a municipal court judge or a municipal court official, a certified municipal court official. In the past, if a warrant complaint was approved, the municipal court judge could approve the warrant complaint and make a determination about bail. And if the defendant was in custody, they could get the be served with a complaint, pay the bail, and walk out the door in a matter of hours. That no longer happens. If a law enforcement official requests the issuance of a warrant complaint, now they have access to a preliminary public safety assessment. So they have a whole lot of additional information upon which to base their assessment. They also have guidelines provided by the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General is the highest law enforcement officer in the state and has issued guidelines on how to on how law enforcement officials should implement criminal justice reform. And any deviation, law enforcement officials are not supposed to deviate from those guidelines, which are published and public and open to scrutiny. So judges, municipal court judges, and court officials also have access to the preliminary public safety assessment. And they, too, are looking at that when they're making decisions on whether or not to issue a complaint warrant. They have the authority to not issue the warrant and issue a complaint summons instead. And they, too, have to document any deviation from the risk assessment established by the public safety assessment. So there's a lot more documentation and guidance going on in our new system. And another change in the system is that anyone who is subject to a complaint warrant is going to jail. They're going to county jail. And they will be held there for up to 48 hours until there's a detention hearing. And that's the second point at which they get review. So if I am charged on a complaint warrant, I will be brought to the county jail. I won't be able to bail myself out. It doesn't matter how much money I have. I'm going to jail. In the jail, I will meet with the pretrial services court staff who will obtain demographic information, employment information, educational information, and complete the public safety assessment. That assessment will then, I'll have access to an attorney. I will have a hearing before a judge who will review whether or not I should be held in custody prior to my trial. The judge will be given a copy of the completed public safety assessment and recommendations from the pretrial services unit, which will include the assessment and recommendations for conditions of release. So when the judge is reviewing whether or not somebody should be detained, they have a lot of options. They are still reviewing to make sure that somebody will show up for trial and won't be a danger to the public or law enforcement and won't commit another offense if released. But the options are not simply release or detain. They can detain with conditions. And some of the conditions that they can utilize are release. They can release you on your own recognizance with no conditions. Or they can release you with an order for no contact with the victim or witnesses, no further criminal activity, no drugs or alcohol, limits on mobility, geographic mobility, requirements to maintain or seek employment, requirement for a psychiatric evaluation, reporting obligations by phone or in person to the pretrial services staff, electronic monitoring by a monitoring bracelet, an electronic ankle bracelet, or home detention and bail. So you can use one or all of those. Well, not probably not all of them. To ensure that if they're going to, as a condition of release in the new bail system. A prosecutor is also present at the hearing and is entitled, and their role is to present evidence, where appropriate, present evidence and argument for more restrictive conditions. And at the point the judge makes the decision, again, if they're deviating from the objective risk assessment, they are required to put the reasons for that deviation in writing. And all of this provides another layer of protection and potential review for defendants. And all decisions made at those hearings are appealable. So, in conclusion, this is just a very brief summary of some of the changes in as we move from the old money-based bail system to the new system that's based on risk assessment. There's a lot more information available at the court's website, which is www.njcourts.gov. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have after the program. So thank you very much. Yes.
Thank you for listening to Clearly Quaker. We hope you have found this podcast thought-provoking. If you have questions or comments, or would like to learn more about South Jersey Quakers, reach us at salemquarter.net.